Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. I'm Anthony Pastore, sitting in our studios in New York City. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, 2024, at 1 p.m. here on the East Coast. Thank you all for joining us. Today, I'm going to be joined by my Chief Investment Office colleagues, Nadia Lovell and Dan Scansaroli, here in just a moment. But before we get to that, just wanted to remind you that we do always appreciate hearing from our audience. So if you have a question, we're going to open it up a little bit later to questions from the audience. There is an Ask a Question button right on the screen, and it allows you to engage with us during today's discussion. So get those questions in. We'll be getting to those a little bit later in the conversations. All right, so let's dive right in. Dan Scansaroli, let me bring you in here. First question, kind of I think we have to start with the biggest macro story, which is all eyes on what the Fed is thinking. We're talking about the FOMC, the Federal Reserve. At yesterday's meeting, at 2 o'clock, when the statement came out, there were really no surprises in there. The Fed kept rates steady for the sixth straight meeting, just hopefully trying to delay this sticky inflation that we're sitting in. We've seen a lot of economic data, particularly with jobs, as the kind of the biggest one of them, indicating that we're still in a bit of a strong economy. So how do you see this impacting the growth and even the policy environment down the road? In other words, is the Fed still going to cut this year? And are there any other key takeaways that really stood out to you?
Yeah, the short answer is we do expect the Fed to cut. But as you mentioned, since the beginning of the year, we've seen actually six straight meetings going back to last year that the Fed has maintained this 5.5% rate for the Fed funds rate. And we do view that as fairly restrictive. But since the beginning of the year, we have seen markets reprice basically from very aggressive cuts. There were six cuts of 25 basis points priced in the market coming into the year to now, markets are expecting more one to possibly two cuts this year with that sticky inflation. With that being said, though, last year we did see significant progress in moderating inflation. However, in the last 3 months, that progress has stagnated, and we've seen a couple of data points that have surprised to the upside. Core inflation, as an example, which excludes food and energy, was up 3.8% year over year in the month of March. But it's not all evenly distributed. What we actually did see is that there was progress on good core goods, which actually deflated by almost 1%. And it was the service side that was really driving that high inflation. We had a 5.4% print for core services in the month of March, year over year. So simultaneously, the economy has continued to grow above trend. We've seen about 1.6% growth in the last quarter. And consumer spending, which is the bigger challenge that we're facing, is the consumers have remained remarkably robust. They've increased spending in the last quarter by about 2.5%. So as the Fed chairman yesterday said, Jerome Powell said, in recent months, there has been a lack of progress towards their 2% target. But they are seeing a better balance overall, relative to last year, in their ability to achieve their goal of moderating inflation, price stability, and labor markets, maximizing the labor market. The labor market is not the challenge they're facing right now. In the past month, though, overall, the robustness of the economy, spending, and inflation have already shifted markets to a mantra of rates remaining higher for longer. So, as you said, this wasn't really a surprise based on where the data went. Markets were already pricing this in. We think markets have gotten a little ahead of themselves in terms of possibly not pricing in enough rate hikes. But the view that we've held since the beginning of the year is that the markets were going to moderate those number of rate cuts this year, and markets are gradually coming in line with the view that we had in the beginning of this year. However, given the restricted level of rates, we do expect inflation to gradually tend lower, particularly because spending continues to rise faster than income. Most households have used up their excess spending, their excess savings that they built up during the pandemic. And simultaneously, we've been seeing credit card debt and record high rates on that credit card debt increasing. Now, this has pushed the savings rate down for the average household below that 6% average to an average household having about 3% savings every single month. All in all, this implies that spending will likely slow later this year, and we expect inflation to fall near 3% by the end of the third quarter. While this implies that the Fed policy should be in the short term to hold rates higher until they see more progress on inflation, Fed officials continue to signal that the rate cuts remain appropriate at some stage, but are electing to be more patient and data-driven until they see the data drive that out. They don't see the need for hikes at this time. They're very clear about that. And you know, as we look at the scenarios and we look at the data, we believe that we are on track for a soft landing, and we would expect to see two rate cuts that start in September.
Terrific. Dan, thank you. Yeah, and I wanted to reiterate that during the press conference yesterday with Jay Powell, there were a few reporters that kept asking him, are you going to start hiking this year? And he said no. I mean, he unequivocally said no. And he also quoted, it's unlikely the next policy move will be a hike. So certainly, I don't think that that's on the table either. Interestingly, just to kind of talk about what you were going on before, there was a measure of consumer confidence that came out this past week, and it fell to the lowest level that we've seen since July 2022. Within that data, it said that the views of Americans that were surveyed, their view on the labor market and their outlook for the economy has deteriorated. So I'm sure it's something that the Fed is keeping a close eye on, including the labor numbers, and we still got those jobs numbers tomorrow. So, you know, as we sit here, there's still things that could change over the next, you know, 24 hours or so. So with that being said, Dan, we've been focusing a lot on what's going on the Treasury side, looking at bond yields. I mean, they have certainly, except for the last session, obviously where the Fed was yesterday with keeping rates unchanged in their comments, we saw rates on the 10-year and 30-year decline a little bit. But up to that point, they had been really rallying. Where do you expect yields to go from here? And what does that essentially mean for fixed income investments?
Yeah, that really also, it's very important for us to focus on where yields have gone so far in order to understand where we should be going next. As I've discussed before, you know, markets have aggressively switched towards that higher for longer mantra, and that's being priced into the markets. The moves yesterday after the Fed were very, very modest, you know, a couple of basis points across the curve. And as markets have repriced the rate cut expectations, the 10-year Treasury has risen over 50 basis points, a little less than that after the moves yesterday, since mid-March to a level around 4.6%. And while rates could continue to increase from here, there's still a possibility that it continues to creep up, even though we've crept down in the last couple of days. We believe it's unlikely that we revisit the 501 highs that we saw in October last year on the 10-year Treasury. The inflation and labor market data were significantly more restrictive at that time. Given this, we would add duration actually at these levels, but acknowledge that the heightened volatility may continue for the next couple of months as we see data come in with the jobs market tomorrow. You know, that they could ultimately restructure what happens at any month as those data that data comes in, and that is going to add some volatility to the rates market. In our base case, we actually believe the 10-year Treasury is about 60 basis points lower than where it is right now. We have a 10-year Treasury target at year end of 385. You know, spreads have also materially tightened as those rates rose, 45 to 50 basis points over the last month and a half. And they're at levels that we believe pose vulnerability to short-term risks like we saw in October 23 for high spread products, you know, those lower grade, lower quality bonds. So we don't have a preference for lower quality bonds, but our preference is to allocate to high quality bonds, which are going to be able to benefit from when the Fed cuts. We're also looking to the MBS market, mortgage-backed securities, CMBS, and we like Treasury inflation protection. Particularly, we've extended our duration, and we recommend extending duration to a 7-year point on the TIPS curve. With rates at current levels, we see markets offering a high degree of what we refer to as positive convexity, which means there is higher upside over downside for bondholders in our assessment. You know, for example, it would take about a 50 basis point rise to wipe out the rest of the year's worth of income on your 10-year Treasury, where you would be even in terms of the price decline from a 50 basis point rise relative to your income. Now, however, if rates were to fall by that same amount, that 50 basis points from here through year end, these bonds could produce a total return over 10%. if rates fall to our target of 3.85, we would expect the 10-year Treasury is likely to produce a total return near 13 or 14%. Relative to taxable investors, the recent increase in yields has pushed the long and short duration, high-quality munici bonds to higher tax-equivalent yields. We're now seeing tax-equivalent yields over 6% for investors who are in the highest federal tax bracket. We generally recommend minimizing exposure to the 4 to 10-year portion of the muni curve. It's shaped very differently than the Treasury curve. The 4 to 10-year part of the curve is offering much less value in terms of income. They're more expensive from an MT ratio, a muni to Treasury trade-off, than taking a barbell between the short and long municipals. This positioning can manage duration risk, just in case we see rates continue to gradually go up. But more importantly, it generates a higher level of income for those long-term investors, tax-free income at the federal level and potentially at the state level, by doing a barbell and avoiding the belly of the muni curve.
Excellent. Dan, thank you very much. Nadia, let me bring you in here because I want to start talking about what's going on the equity side of the market when we look at the month of April. It was choppy, certainly, for markets, and a lot of that has to do with these inflation numbers, the data that we keep seeing. So what does the current environment that we're in, meaning stubborn, sticky inflation, and perhaps more delayed rate cuts, what does it mean for stocks?
Thanks, Anthony. You know, Anthony, if I may, you know, zoom out, and then we'll zoom in. But I would say, broadly speaking, we don't think this persistent inflation, one, we don't think it's going to last. And we don't think that the delayed rate cuts will be too much of a headwind for the aggregate market, especially if that's being accompanied by strong economic growth and a still fairly strong job market. As you noted, we'll get payrolls numbers tomorrow, but we still expect to see strong numbers in payrolls. You know, we have already seen some evidence of this so far. You have an S&P 500 that's up 5% year to date. Despite the fact that you've had a significant repricing in the rates market, the rates market has swung from, you know, pricing in 175 basis points of cuts back in January of this year to just about 35 basis points today. Now, as you noted, equities have been choppy over the last month, but reality is the pullback was no more than about 5% off of the late March all-time highs, and volatility did reach a six-month high. But we know that that was not only due to inflation and rates, Anthony. We know that we did have a period of heightened geopolitical tension and what's going on in the Middle East. So that did weigh on the market. But on balance, what you've seen as a whole, the market has really been able to weather this higher for longer rate environment quite well. You know, as you know, rates might be on hold for longer. As you noted, Chairman Powell yesterday basically removed that tail risk of rate hikes, noting that the next action of the Fed is unlikely to be a hike. So the market took some comfort in that. It's not a matter of when, it's more of a matter of when rates will be cut and not if they will be cut. And that's important. What's important here is that the Fed put also is still alive. You know, that willingness for the Fed to really step in at any signs of weakness in the labor market. So we were watching that very closely. So that somewhat dovish tone that we had from Chairman Powell yesterday was supportive to risk assets. Now, let's zoom in. You know, there are some pockets of the market, admittedly, that are just more sensitive to rates. You know, like we have the real estate sector, utilities, small caps. But I will note, though, Anthony, of late, that utilities have been surprising to the upside. You know, they've been able to overcome that headwind from rates, and that's partly due to the AI trade and that increase in demand for power to data centers. That trade is alive as well in utilities. But for real estate and small cap, that just hasn't been the case. You know, that's partly because for both of these areas, there's just less confidence in the earnings outlook for those segments. You know, despite the underperformance that we've seen in REITs, they're still a little bit expensive given the current level of real rates. And there's some areas of that market that's seen earnings downgrade just due to new capacity that's coming online and just an overall slowdown in leasing demand. Now, for small cap, As you know, Anthony, over 40% of small cap debt is floating rate. So that level of short-term rate is a headwind. But beyond that, when you look at the earnings, you know, there is an expectation for low teens earnings growth for this year, but there's still a fair amount of uncertainty. And earnings estimates, quite frankly, has been moving a bit lower for small caps. So that's something also bear watching. So, Anthony, at the S&P 500 index level, the delay rate cuts, less of a headwind, but it remains one for some of those more interest rate sensitive rate areas like REITs and small cap that still seem somewhat shackled to rates for now.
Great. Thank you, Nadia. Just going to remind our audience here, if you have a question for Nadia or for Dan, make sure to click that Ask a Question button on your screen, and we'll get to those in a couple minutes. And before I get back to Nadia, just to kind of level set here, since we are a live show, the S&P 500 right now is sitting at a 5,049. That's up about 0.6% for the day. And the 10-year Treasury, the yield right now is a 4.59, just to kind of keep everybody honest here. So, Nadia, let me get back to you here for a second. So, aside from the news on that macro front, when we're talking about Fed, the macro economy, et cetera, we are now about a little less than two-thirds of the way through equity earnings season. It continues to be in full swing. And, you know, by market cap anyway, we're about two-thirds of the way through. So what are maybe some of your takeaways so far? How have we been doing? How's the guidance looking? And what is it telling you?
Yeah, you know, from in terms of number of S&P companies, we're about three-quarters of the way through the reporting season. You know, so far, Anthony, companies have been beaten and by a healthy amount. And that's putting earnings to be on track to coming in higher than what we initially had expected. Our expectations was even above consensus. We're looking for 7-9% earnings growth for the quarter, and we might get a little bit even better than that. You might recall, Anthony, that we did have an earnings recession last year from the S&P 500. That ended last year with the third quarter when we saw earnings for the aggregate index flip back into the black for the third quarter. But all of that was driven by the tremendous rebound in growth by the Mag 7. The rest of the S&P 493 in aggregate was still negative. But Anthony, this is a quarter, Q1, where growth could finally flip back into the black for them. And so far, that's what we're seeing. And so what's important about this season is that broadening out of earnings growth to the other sectors, which we expect to really continue and accelerate for the rest of this year. So to encapsulate it, you know, solid earnings season with growth broadening out, constructive outlook. We're seeing second quarter and the 12-month forward estimates, they're moving higher. Now, in terms of some themes and some learnings that we can tease out for the quarter so far, again, the lower income consumer remains under pressure. So no real surprise here. You know, this is due to a high inflation. And I would say, according to a large bank executive, the excess savings for the lower 50% is almost exhausted. And, you know, Dan alluded to that earlier. The consumer is becoming, you know, increasingly budget conscious. Their spending habits are shifting. There is a little bit of fatigue that's really kicking in on all the price increases that we've seen over the last few years. I know I'm a little fatigued by it myself. Some consumer package companies are pointing to the consumer becoming even more choosy and looking for increased value. Companies are now having less pricing power as their customers are pushing back. So we are seeing some pullback in goods. And this is somewhat consistent with what we saw in the first quarter GDP numbers, you know, but consumption on services remain quite robust, Anthony. You know, for instance, the cruise lines, they're seeing record bookings. So if you're going on a cruise and you haven't booked yet, you might be out of luck, Anthony. But, you know, to be clear, the overall consumer, the collective consumer does remain healthy. Now, we heard that from the banks and the credit card companies. They noted credit quality remain benign. Delinquency rates seems to be topping out, and most banks are, you know, believe that net charge-offs will be peak around mid-year. And as a priority for the banks, what we've heard, loan growth somewhat anemic still, but capital markets activities are picking up. We're seeing IPOs finally again, M&A, and some of the banks are really benefited from this higher for longer rate environment. You might recall last year, there was a lot of concern around potential recession. So the banks had reserved for that. And now we're seeing a release of some of those reserves that they had put aside because the weakness just hasn't materialized in the economy. And then if I can just quickly touch on tech, because I know that's top of mind for many of us, and you know, it is the most preferred sector for us. You know, trends in tech has been positive. I mean, the strong trends that we're seeing in AI, we're seeing increasing CapEx, AI monetization, you know, some of the recovery in PCs and smartphones, a little bit bumpy in analog and industrials and autos, semi-end markets remain somewhat anemic. Cloud computing growth is finally accelerating again. You know, businesses are resuming their spending on technology projects. There are some bottlenecks within AI, of course, that because demand is running ahead of capacity. But Anthony, AI is fueling beats not only in technology companies, but also in other sectors like industrials. You know, as you might know, some of these companies are involved in the build out of data centers, and they're crucial to the cooling of data centers. If I may, Anthony, I'll plug a great UBS trending video that was released this week. It was titled AI Through an Industrial Lens, a great one to watch. I encourage our viewers to check it out if they haven't already. It's a video in which our industrials and materials equity strategist, Nathaniel Gabel, breaks it down for you in simple terms and also discuss the investment opportunities. Anthony, Nathaniel was great. The moderator might not be as good as you were, Anthony, of course, but it's still worth a great watch. It's still a great watch.
Thank you, Nadia. So I was going to say I missed that because I wasn't on a cruise. I'm more of a beach vacation kind of traveler, but I was definitely out of the studio. But I watched the show. It really was terrific, and it's always nice to have you on, too. And I also wanted to say, Nadia, you know, something in the most recent CIO Houseview publication talks about, you talked about capital spending from some of these major tech companies, you know, and it's related to AI. The top three are spending something like $140 billion this year, according to their records. So there's so much opportunity here in tech, as you've been saying. And just to kind of tie it back to what Dan was saying before, you talked about the consumer being maybe a little bit more picky on prices. As Dan mentioned, a lot of consumers gotten rid of, or they've spent the savings that they had during the pandemic because, let's face it, we all went out and spent money when the doors opened again for us to go into restaurants and take vacations. And so it's not surprising to hear where this is going. Let me just then have you, Nadia, kind of put this all together. So what opportunities, now we're talking still within the equity space, what opportunities are you leaning into right now when it comes to equities and sectors?
Yeah, our U.S. sector preferences have remained unchanged this month, Anthony. We still like tech for some of the reasons we talked about, industrials as well, and healthcare. You know, tech has been volatile of late. You know, we've seen some profit taking over the last month or so. But I would say the earnings season, some of those numbers that you just quoted reconfirm our positive view on the sector. You know, you're seeing strong end market AI demands and real evidence of monetization. You know, in industrials, we're seeing inventory destocking is now behind us. ISM manufacturing PMI yesterday, the business activity, you know, continues to oscillate a bit around that contraction and expansion demarcation line. But the bottom does seem to be in, and things should improve in our view as the year progresses. And then the sector, of course, has the AI kicker that I just talked about earlier, and then overall just positive impact from infrastructure spending. Healthcare is our defensive play. I mean, it has the diabetes and obesity. Some of the leaders in this vertical continue to post very solid earnings, you know, despite the fact that we're seeing some supply constraints for the GLP-1 drugs. You know, I would say, you know, market could remain choppy near term. You've used that term earlier, but we think that the S&P 500 will remain in an uptrend. And so we would be adding a weakness and also using derivative strategies to be a good way to take advantage of some of the volatility. One thing, although I will also highlight outside the U.S., Anthony, you know, our European strategy team did upgrade the U.K. market to most preferred. The region does offer some attractive value. The domestic economic environment seems to be improving. The market does have meaningful exposure to commodities and should also benefit from higher commodity prices. And then the Bank of England, you know, the Fed might be delayed, but other central banks seem positioned to start cutting rates pretty soon. So we think that should be positive for some of the consumer recovery plays, as well as UK banks, where you could see net interest margins should start to improve in the second half of the year. So that's how we're thinking about positioning within equities within the U.S. and outside of the U.S., Anthony.
Great. Thank you, Nadia. And stick around because we are getting some audience questions in. But before we get to those, I have one last question for you, Dan. And I know this is a very top of mind topic and a sensitive one, you know, for the fact that we're, you know, talking about geopolitics. There's been a lot going on around the world, the ongoing tensions in the Middle East, you know, Russia-Ukraine conflict, that war is still raging on. There's a lot happening, and I know your team has done a lot of work looking at the historical relationships between geopolitics and, of course, the financial markets. First of all, what did you find? And for those clients who are, you know, sticking purely with the investment question, who are nervous about their investments because of these conflicts, are there ways to hedge some of that downside risk?
Anthony, we actually looked at 28 major conflicts and wars dating back to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. And in that research, what we found is that the uncertainty at the beginning of a crisis can cause an initial downturn in the market, which isn't a surprise, doesn't always cause a downturn. However, any of those downturns tend to be temporary in nature. In over two-thirds of the crises and wars that we looked at, the S&P 500 recovered with a positive return within 3 months. We also find that staying invested for the long term, 3 years or longer, as an example, after a crisis, has rarely resulted in a loss of capital. About 90% of the time, markets have produced positive returns with an average return of about 21%. You know, the war in the Middle East, as you brought up, and even with the conflicts that we've had with the war in Ukraine, the war in the Middle East has generally outperformed these trends. Since October 7th, Hamas attacking Israel, the S&P is up about 18% since that attack on October 7th. Additionally, a few weeks ago, we had the attack of Israel, Iran, obviously, attacking Israel, and you know, a little back and forth in terms of exchanging fire. Since then, the S&P is only down about 1.5% from the April 12th attack. For investors who are nervous, though, around these geopolitical risks and want to hedge them, bonds still remain one of the most effective tools when there's a flight to quality in a crisis and people get concerned. However, you know, conflicts in oil-sensitive regions have a wide impact on various economies, and therefore, it may also be prudent, considering where these conflicts are occurring, holding gold and holding oil. We also like macro hedge funds. All of these three different strategies tend to provide a counterbalance to these types of economic risks. You know, since the attack on the war with Hamas, we've seen actually oil increase about 27%. We thought it was underpriced when it went through, when that attack happened. But overall, you know, we still see further upside in terms of holding gold as a hedge if there is an escalation. Additionally, given the relatively low level of equity volatility and the high yielding environment we're in, this tends to be the optimal combination for commodity and equity-linked structured investments that have downside protection, and that creates an attractive opportunity to hedge those downside risks without losing exposure to the potential upside if those risks don't materialize.
Great, Dan, thank you very much. Let's get to some audience questions now. By the way, thank you everybody for sending them in. We may not get to all of them, but we'll do our best. And Dan, since we have you, let me stay with you because the question came in asking about tax-free municipal bonds. Are 10 plus years good? Because earlier you were talking about that, you know, 6 to 8 years or 5 to 7 years period, maybe not looking as good, but is 10 plus good for munis?
10 plus is good positioning. Part of this is also a preference in terms of the duration risk that you're taking in the muni market. We generally would like to see investors, they're getting more value at the 14-year plus part of the municipal curve. The municipal curve right now looks like the Big Dipper, if I can make an analogy. On that spoon, the front of the curve, the short-dated maturity bonds are at a very high level in terms of above 3.5% yield. That's And then it precipitously falls down between 4 and 10 years. You're at a trough, and then it goes up at a 45-degree angle until you get about the 15-year part of the curve, and then it levels off and gradually increases. And that's important because where you're getting the most value is obviously on the really short end of 2 year and less maturity bonds, where you're getting that 3.5 or higher yield. And then on the 15-year plus, 3.5 going all the way up to 4% as you take on more of that duration risk. Now, that duration risk obviously comes with the chances that if rates are to increase from here, you could see mark-to-market losses on your municipal bonds. But if you're holding to maturity and you're holding high-quality triple and double A bonds, we wouldn't expect them to default, and we would expect them to, over the 20 or 15-year period, obviously converge to par. So if you're planning on holding for the long term, you're taking a lot less risk for that duration. If you don't have any liquidity needs, you know, you may be able to extend duration even further out and increase your overall tax equivalent yield from 6% up to 7 or 8, depending on the state that you live in. But generally, we're trying to minimize, you know, between the 4 and 10 year part of the curve.
Thank you, Dan. Nadia, let me ask you this next question that came in asking about CPI, which is the Consumer Price Index, and that's an inflationary measure. And the question is, if the April and May print on CPI come in better than expected, do you think the Fed would cut rates in June, which seems soon because there's still a jobs number that we still have to wait for before that June meeting anyway. So anyway, that question is, if we see better CPI, what are you thinking?
You know, I think Chairman Powell gave two paths for rate cuts. One, progress on inflation, and two, any weakness in the labor market. We'll get CPI on May 15, and I believe the next one is June 12, which is also the day of the next FOMC. And so I think it would be too soon to see a cut, assuming that the job market still remains strong. The fact is we've had 3 months of hot print. So I think that the Fed wants to see at least three months of the other way in terms of progress on inflation before making a decision to cut. So it seems to us that there will not be enough data to be able to assess that trend to give the Fed the confidence until we get to the September meeting, which is why we think that the cut comes in September. So unless there's weakness in the labor market, that is probably the only thing that will accelerate a cut to June, less so than the inflation picture, unless inflation significantly drop off, which we don't think that it will. We think it's the data will be gradual trend down back towards the disinflationary path, and that's going to take a few more than 2 months.
Excellent. Thank you, Nadia. By the way, that September meeting is September 17th and 18th for our audience, the second day obviously being the one where the statement is released. I know we're a little over our 30-minute mark, but let's do two more questions that have come in. Dan, this one for you, and it asks, are there opportunities in private markets given that, you know, there's higher public market valuations right now? And I know that's something that you and your team are always looking at.
Yeah, no. For investors who can tolerate a degree of limited, liquidity, we are seeing opportunities in value-oriented buyout strategies and secondaries. As you and Nadia had pointed out, valuations on the S&P 500 have strongly increased to a level that's getting in the expensive realm at 23 times earnings. However, within the buyout equity, private equity space, we've actually seen the opposite trends. We've seen that valuations have come down 10% in the last year and over 32% since a very strong deal-making environment in 2021. And that's generally measured on their enterprise value relative to their EBITDA, their earnings, before interest, taxes, and amortization, which is the measure for private companies. This has created more attractive entry points for investors. It's also, we have to be very selective in terms of what types of private equity deals we're going into. Given the high cost of capital and borrowing and where rates are, we tend to like managers which are structuring buyout deals through operational improvements and lower price multiples rather than relying on leverage, which has been the trend for the last 10 years, or financial engineering in order to create that value. Within the secondary market, we're current investors who have committed to private investments look to get out of those commitments by unwinding it to another private investor. in the secondary market. We are seeing another quite attractive opportunity of transacting in the secondary market, in the buyout and growth space, at 15% discounts to the net asset value. So the normal valuation that these companies would be if there was a deal, would be expected at that net asset value. And we're seeing these very strong discounts. Those discounts are even stronger in the venture capital space, where secondaries are seeing 30% discounts on average as well. And you get away from one of the advantages of going in secondaries is you get away from what we refer to as blind pool risk. When you typically commit to a private equity fund, you don't know exactly which companies ultimately you're going to deploy capital in. With secondaries, you are buying a book of companies which you can evaluate, and you know what the value opportunity is and how you're going to operationally improve that value creation process. The large size of these discounts, they've evolved because deal flow in the last 2 years has been muted and stagnant in terms of the M&A environment, mergers and acquisitions. We're seeing that pick up in activity now, and both general and limited partners are seeking liquidity for new commitments or rebalancing their portfolios. We expect better deal flow and lower rates to be supportive for attractive returns in private equity. Historically, an investment in PE buyout strategies has outperformed the S&P by about 5.5% annualized on average when we look at data from Cambridge Associates.
Dan, thank you very much. And let's get to that final audience question. And Nadia, I'll pass it back to you. And it's asking about commodities. It's not an uncommon question that we get on this particular live show. Just asking gold, oil, you know, the commodities that we're looking at, are there opportunities here? What do we think about that?
Yeah, you know, gold has actually been pretty strong this year, you know, even better than our already bullish expectations. We have seen a little bit of weakness in the last few weeks, a pullback from the April high. And some of the strength that we've seen so far this year has really been driven by strong demand from central banks and Asia investors. And central banks have just been purchasing at a record level. We think that that will continue to support gold here. Gold actually could get another leg up when the Fed starts to cut, as again, we expect those cuts to come in starting in September. And then the usual ETF buyers will likely start to step in at that point. In terms of like our target, our year-end target is $2,500 per ounce for gold. So that's about, 10% or so upside from here, Anthony. We could see some volatility here and there just depending on how strong the U.S. economy is and the timing of Fed cut. But we think that gold, as you know, is a safe haven asset, and we recommend using it as a diversifier. Now, in terms of oil, we do have a most preferred preference on oil. Oil, too, has been volatile of late. Some of this having to do with geopolitical tensions in the Middle East. Some of that risk premium has come out of oil in the recent week. There's also, as sort of that threat of supply disruption seems to have receded. Also, I would say this week we're seeing a bit of a weakness on oil as well due to just concerns around inventory building. We don't expect this to last. Some of this is just due to lower exports and lower refinery runs that we've seen recently. We expect inventory draws to happen in June. We could see oil remain in this trading range until we get to the OPEC meeting in June. Anthony, we recently lifted our expectations for Brent oil by $5. We're now looking for $91 for June and $87 for December. And this has to do with the fact that demand has been coming in stronger than expected, and we do have those OPEC plus cuts still in play. So we think that the market will remain under supply. We're looking for Brent oil to kind of trade in this range of $85 to $95 in the near term. And then we expect OPEC to production cuts to be unwind, but unwind very gradually as we head into the back half of the year. So at these levels, we would be buyers of oil.
Nadia, thank you very much. Thanks for that question. And by the way, just for a point of reference, gold is sitting right now at $2,318 an ounce. That's about up 12.5% for the year. And then on the oil side, WTI crude, $79.10 a barrel. up about 10% for the year. So great questions, and thank you all for participating in those audience questions. And thanks again to Nadia and Dan, two incredible guests, to sit with me today for the last 40 minutes or so. And thank you for spending time with us. Just to keep you updated, our next CIO Monthly live stream is going to take place on Thursday, June 6th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's always the first Thursday of the month, so you can mark your calendars for that. Until then, please visit our website, ubs.com/views. There's great CIO content up there that focuses on our latest views through our House View publications, our CIO alerts, our videos. Like Nadia said, we've got our show called UBS Trending and a new series, UBS Road to the Election, as well as podcasts and other pieces of multimedia featuring more colleagues from UBS and, of course, our best partners on Wall Street. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Until next time, from New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Have a great day, everyone. We'll see you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.